From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. At this morning's National Prayer Breakfast, President Trump made jokes about how the ratings for The Apprentice have fallen during Arnold Schwarzenegger's hosting. Please pray for The Apprentice ratings, the president said. Then he said this.
The world is in trouble, but we're going to straighten it out, okay? That's what I do. I fix things. We're going to straighten it out. Believe me, when you hear about the tough phone calls I'm having, don't worry about it. Just don't worry about it.
Now, both the Washington Post and the Australian Broadcasting Corporation are reporting what sounds like a very difficult call on Saturday, the day after Trump issued his executive orders on immigration. It was between Trump and Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, Trump reportedly excoriating Turnbull over a refugee agreement signed by the Obama administration, accusing Turnbull of trying to export more Boston bombers and ending the call abruptly. That old agreement concerned a little over 1,000 of the thousands of people who tried to reach Australia by boat last year, a dangerous, deadly journey. Australian leaders of both political parties supported stopping the asylum seekers at detention centers on islands off the coast to discourage the wave. Conditions became deplorable. The UN stepped in. The U.S. agreed to take up to 1,250 people. Last night, President Trump tweeted out a dumb deal. Today, Press Secretary Sean Spicer basically said, it's not a done deal. Zoe Daniel is Washington Bureau Chief of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. She found herself in the middle of this flare-up. Zoe, fascinating.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? And it's all to do with timing in the sense that, as you said, this phone call came at virtually the exact time the Trump administration was rolling out its travel bans on people from seven majority Muslim nations. Now, the people on those islands, the majority of them are from Iran, some are from Iraq, some are from Somalia, and there are a few Syrians. So this is the exact group of people that is targeted, of course, by the executive order. So in that sense, it seems the president felt somewhat backed into a corner. There was a clause inserted into the executive order that pre-existing deals could still be honoured despite the executive order being signed. But clearly, Donald Trump was not happy about it. I guess what's interesting, too, politically, is that the Australian government, since the phone call with the president on the weekend, has been saying, no problem, the deal's on, the president is going to honour it. But we have been hearing and reporting from other sources within the White House that the president was certainly still not happy with it, that he was still considering whether to honour it at all.
Well, in fact, take us through this, because two contrary things were happening at once. You have the president's spokesperson, Sean Spicer, saying the deal was probably going to happen. But then you got a phone call from a senior White House aide telling you what? And by the way, can you tell us who it was?
I'd prefer not to say who it was, only because she asked to be referred to as a senior White House official. So I will honour that. But yes, you're right. In the White House briefing earlier this week, I asked Sean Spicer directly what the status of the deal was, whether it would go ahead and whether it would be altered at all by the president's executive order. He said that as long as the people who were subject to the terms of the deal were subjected to extreme vetting, the deal would be able to move forward. And then about 3 hours later, I had a phone call from someone else, as I said, within the White House, who said, actually, it's not quite that clear cut. Just so we're on the same page, you need to know that the president is actually still considering whether to go ahead with the deal. And I said, do you mean after those people are vetted? And she said, no, we're considering whether to go ahead with the deal at all. We then received a statement from the State Department saying, no problem, the deal will go ahead because of Australia's strong relationship with the US. Then the story broke from the Washington Post about the phone call and the testy nature of it between Mr. Trump and Mr. Turnbull. And then Donald Trump tweeted last night that he is, in fact, still thinking about whether to go ahead with the deal. So it's a very confusing chain of events, but that's what happened.
Look, your national affairs correspondent finished a column today with the words, leaders the world over, beware. How is this resonating in Australia?
I think broadly Australians would feel quite upset about it in the sense that Australia has a very close relationship with the US, particularly on defence, has a very strong intelligence and defence rapport.
In fact, we just remind people, Australia is such a close ally of the US. It's one of only four countries that the US includes in sharing its espionage and security information, and they do not spy on each other. So it's a very close relationship.
Yeah, Australia is part of what's called the Five Eyes relationship, as you say, and there is that sense of being friends. So I think some Australians might feel a bit hurt by the tone of it. But that said, the Prime Minister was asked about it yesterday. He kind of pushed it off, saying, look, this sometimes tough conversations have to be had, and I'll just keep to myself what was actually said. He hasn't really pushed back on what the tone of the conversation was.
That's Zoe Daniel, Washington Bureau Chief of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, who found herself in the middle of this diplomatic spat. Zoe, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, we've heard about Syrian refugees who have just arrived in the U.S., the last to arrive before President Trump banned Syrian refugees indefinitely in that executive order last week, including some in Rutland, Vermont. But what about those in camps in Jordan awaiting resettlement? Nina Keck from Here and Now contributor Vermont Public Radio went to Jordan to find out.
In the bustling city of Amman, midday traffic mixes with tradition as an elderly man sits on the sidewalk playing a wooden oud, the Middle Eastern ancestor of the modern guitar. 9.5 million people live in Jordan, almost half in this sprawling capital city. Since war broke out in neighboring Syria in 2011, hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees have poured over the border seeking safety. So many that today, one out of every 10 people in Jordan is Syrian. At a downtown cafe, four young university students, all wearing hijabs or headscarves, sit at a corner table enjoying coffee and cigarettes. 20-year-old Sondos Gaith says the refugee situation is a huge problem in Jordan, and she says she's frustrated by what she calls the racist U.S. decision to halt resettlement of Syrians and others from predominantly Muslim countries.
We help the Syrians because they're our brothers, and they're very close, and they're Arabs like us. And even if they weren't Arabs, we help anybody that comes into Jordan. We help the Iraqis, the Egyptians. The problem is that the Jordanian economy is very weak and cannot hold all that pressure helping so many people.
The protests, violence, and demonstrations that broke out across the Middle East beginning in 2010 with the Arab Spring greatly reduced tourism to Jordan. Border crossings in the region have further slowed the economy. Jordan is taking on the burden of the Syrian refugee crisis, the young women point out. The international community needs to help, too. Across town, at a sprawling 8-story apartment complex, Syrian refugee children play soccer in an alley strewn with trash. Mohammed Al-Hafeth watches from the sidewalk. A Syrian, he says the bombing and warfare in Damascus got to be too much, and he and his wife and 5 children fled to Jordan 4 years ago. He says they'd concluded 2 interviews and were well into the process of being considered for resettlement to the United States until news of the president's executive order last week.
We got destroyed mentally, myself and my kids. We went down to the ground. There is no more hope at all.
For many other families he knows, it was even worse.
There's a lot of people. A lot of people got destroyed. Some people, they were ready to leave. They sold their furniture. They turned in their apartment. And all of a sudden, they're getting a call from the UN saying that things have stopped. These guys got traumatized big time.
The United States resettles more refugees than any other country in the world and has for years. Despite that, U.S. refugee officials in Jordan weren't commenting on the Trump administration's new policy or what it means for refugees in Jordan. Douglas DeSalvo, a senior protection officer in Jordan with the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees, was circumspect.
We've seen challenges before, and we've seen security concerns take a dominant role. We've also seen those security concerns addressed successfully. And I think the fact that a very strong resettlement program was able to be maintained not only by the United States, but by many countries and even increased in the years following the 9/11 attacks is a testament to the ability of the systems and the institutions to find ways to continue to respond to the needs that are out there.
But Ahmed Saa, a 36-year-old Syrian refugee who's been in Jordan for almost 4 years, is not sure how much longer he can wait. Standing outside his apartment with his three young children, he says they too had completed several security interviews and were hopeful they'd be resettled into the United States, only to be disappointed.
We go through a lot of security clearance here in Jordan before they even take us out. So why does he feel that there's a threat? Why is he banning the Muslims? What have we done? We've been here for 4 years and haven't gotten in any kind of a trouble. Why are they afraid? All we wanted to do is live in peace and provide for our family and contribute to the community.
We just don't understand, he says. We just don't understand. For Here and Now, I'm Nina Keck in Amman, Jordan.
The stock market has been dancing around 20,000, a milestone in the upward swing since the election. And since the market bottomed out in 2009, the Dow has more than tripled. Not everyone is buying it. Joining us now is Larry Summers, former U.S. Treasury Secretary under President Clinton and President Emeritus of Harvard University. He also served as one of President Obama's chief economic advisors. Larry Summers, welcome back.
I'm glad to be with you.
So you say that the markets and the economy are enjoying a sugar high right now. What do you mean?
I think there's a real chance that we're seeing a period of a kind of temporary euphoria. People hope that there are going to be a bunch of breaks for business. It's not clear those breaks will materialize. And I'm not sure markets are recognizing the longer-term risks of the path that we're on. The longer-term risks of undermining the global system through protectionism, the longer-term risks of undermining American society by sacrificing traditional values of openness, religious freedom, and non-discrimination, and perhaps most profoundly, the broad enlightenment values of evidence-based decision-making, the rule of law, decisions based on principle rather than ad hoc deals and threats. I think those three things together represent a real threat to the underlying health of our economy. And ultimately, markets follow fundamentals. And if you're doing things that are adverse for the fundamentals of the American economy and the American society, ultimately, that's going to have implications for markets. You know, historians have studied authoritarian governments, whether in Latin America, whether in Europe in the 1930s, and they've talked about something called a populist policy cycle. At first, it all looks good, and people feel better, markets respond confidently. But because of the basic unsoundness of the policies, things ultimately fall apart. That, I think, is a risk here in the United States. Now, look, it's early days, and government may change its course. That's what we've got to hope. We're an extraordinarily resilient country with great and profound strengths. But I'm concerned that within 6 months to a year, if government operates as it has for the last 10 days, 2 weeks, since President Trump took office, I think the consequences could be quite severe.
So beyond the stock market right now, what are you looking at in other parts of the economy, other markets that may give us an indication of what's going to happen? Or do you see any signs of weakness anywhere at the moment?
You know, the fourth quarter GDP figures were disappointing relative to what people expected. That's got to be telling you something. You listen to sentiment of business leaders in Davos, not what they say publicly, but what they say privately. You listen to foreign officials who've never seen anything like this from the United States, a country that they had hugely admired. And all of that has to give concern. What I think everybody needs to remember is that if you look at post-war American history, there's not been a single recession that was forecast a year in advance by the IMF, by the Congressional Budget Office, by the Federal Reserve, by the consensus of professional forecasters. And so when you're taking these kinds of risks, it's never obvious. It's never obvious that a recession is going to come, but the risk is there.
So if somebody's listening to this saying, well, does this mean I should sell my stocks right now or should, you know, change my portfolio? What would you say to them?
Usually moving in and out of the market based on your gut feeling doesn't work out well for even professionals, much less for people who are amateurs. But it strikes me that this is certainly a bad time to be going out of one's way to take risk. If you look at markets, they're projecting a great deal of serenity, and I don't think there's a strong foundation for that kind of prediction of serenity.
Larry Summers, a former U.S. Treasury Secretary and President Emeritus of Harvard University. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, it's Groundhog Day, and in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, Phil the Groundhog saw his shadow, predicting six more weeks of winter. That ritual was immortalized in the 1993 film Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray as Phil Connors, a weatherman covering the groundhog.
That must mean that we're up here at Gobbler's Knob, waiting for the forecast from the world's most famous groundhog weatherman, Punxsutawney Phil.
The film was more than just a 90s comedy. It's thought to be so culturally significant that it was added to the National Film Registry in 2006, and it's preserved in the Library of Congress. NPR film critic Bob Mondello joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good to be here.
And for people who haven't seen this film, or at least haven't seen it in a while, just remind us of the plot of Groundhog Day.
Well, it's basically that Bill Murray goes to Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, to talk about the Groundhog Day. It's a job he absolutely loathes. He's a weatherman. And he finds himself stuck in a time loop. Every morning he wakes up to the same Sonny and Cher song, I Got You, Babe,
right,
which is possibly the most repetitive song in the history of the world, and then finds himself repeating the same day. And initially, you know, when he wakes up the second day and it's happening again, he thinks it's a dream. And then after a while, he starts to realize that he can do anything and he's still going to wake up the next morning with no repercussions and it's going to be the same morning. So he starts being really hedonistic for a while and then he commits suicide a few times and ultimately he decides to better himself, to make himself a better person.
And we learn about the good and bad of living the same day over and over again. The good being some of the humor in this film. And let's just play a clip of it. Phil has to deal with seeing his high school classmate, Ned Ryerson, on the street over and over again every day. Here's the first time the two see each other.
Phil? Hey, Phil? Phil? Phil Connors? Phil Connors, I thought that was you.
How you doing? Thanks for watching.
Hey. Now, don't you tell me you don't remember me, because I sure as heck fire remember you.
Not a chance.
Ned! Ryerson! Needle Nose Ned, Ned the Head. Come on, buddy. Case Western High!
So, there are a lot of funny scenes in this movie.
Well, and they are repeated. When they're funny, they are you see them again and again and again, which is a kind of hell in a way. But it's also – it is. It's very funny.
Now, it's also a movie that for some people is scary. I have friends that don't want to watch Groundhog Day because it's frightening to them. You talked about the fact that, you know, he does get suicidal at times. But what about that, that it's kind of dark?
Well, imagine being stuck in the same day, and you know, isn't that the sort of when you're in high school, every day is different. When you're in college, every day is different. Then you get out into the real world, you get a job, and you're doing the same thing basically every day. I mean, I'm pretty lucky. I get to watch different movies
right
every day. But a lot of people are stuck in jobs that they're not terribly comfortable with, and it sounds awful. It sounds really grim to be stuck in the same thing over and over again. I understand that in for people in the military, they started referring to time in Iraq, for instance, as being Groundhog Day-ish. Mm. I mean, that it was – you were doing the same thing every day. It didn't seem to have any effect. You would have to do it exactly the same way the next day.
Now, he does – Bill Murray in Groundhog Day does kind of learn from what's going on and start mm-hmm. to pick up some tricks, including in a scene with Andy McDowell, who plays Phil's producer, Rita, and he, you know, wants to date her. And he finally, after going out with her a few times, figures out exactly what drink she likes and what she likes to make a toast to. Let's listen.
Sweet vermouth, rocks with a twist, please.
For you, miss?
The same. That's my favorite drink.
Mine, too. It always makes me think of Rome. The way the sun hits the buildings in the afternoon.
Well, what should we drink to?
I like to say a prayer and drink to world peace.
To world peace.
So, which is what she had told him that she likes to do when she has a drink. But why, Bob, does this movie still have such an audience so many years after it came out?
Well, I think basically the premise of the plot is one that is in its way appealing, that you can improve yourself. If you just had a do-over, if you could just do that moment again, you've had that experience where you have a conversation, you walk away, and you think of the thing that you ought to have said.
Yeah.
Well, he gets to go back and do it. It's also, don't forget, sort of a perfect Bill Murray movie. Here's a guy who does craziness really well, and you get to see what amount to a whole bunch of different takes of the same scene. Right? So that you get to see all the different ways he might have done something, which is an appeal too.
Bob Mondello, NPR's film critic, remembering one of the great comedies of the 90s, Groundhog Day. Bob, thank you.
Thank you. I feel like we've done this before.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Some new parents at some American companies are seeing new benefits. There's Netflix's famous unlimited parental leave for a child's first year. The private equity firm KKR offers new parents free plane tickets for nannies on business trips. Ernst & Young offers coaches for new parents returning to work. But these are exceptions. In fact, the Labor Department says that only 12% of private sector workers have access to paid family leave. So what can employers do to support working parents and to retain them? Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us in the studio. And Kurt, that's a big part of this. There was one study that found, to the company's surprise, it wasn't brand new parents that were leaving. It was parents leaving like after a year and a half.
Yeah, it's really important for companies to actually get a sense of how are working parents working in their organizations right now. And so it may turn out that they come back to work, but if they leave in a year, then you're going to have to replace them anyway. You're going to have to hire somebody new. You're going to have to retrain somebody new. So make sure this works and figure out exactly who your parents are.
And what is it that they need after that year and a half they're not getting? So there's some examples of what companies can do that doesn't involve a lot of cost, including categorizing after-hours emails.
Yeah, so just understand that being a parent is super stressful and working is stressful. So if you are sending emails as a manager in the evening or on the weekends, maybe you'd want to label them for Monday, not urgent, FYI, just to be more considerate of that person's time.
Because they may be going to a ballet recital, as you write. The studies have found too much focus on new biological mothers, you know, providing space for breastfeeding, which is very important, but expanding what the needs are.
Yeah, you have to remember that there are all sorts of parents in your company. There are adoptive parents. There are same-sex parents. Like, parenthood is sort of an 18-year lifestyle bomb, right? Mm-hmm. It just changes everything. And so focusing on those first months, super important, not the whole picture.
Okay. Non-negotiable vacation, or make vacation time non-negotiable. What's that about? It's like telling your people to go away?
This is making sure that people take advantage of the benefits and resources that you do offer, because not every company can afford to give somebody 12 months leave or buy plane tickets for nannies, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very different picture. But if you are offering vacation, make sure that employees are actually taking that. And some companies actually put that at the top of performance reviews. They'll say vacation days taken, or they'll send out, they'll do voicemails or emails just reminding people to take vacation days before the summer. So just make sure that people are taking advantage of the time off you're giving them, and also know about the resources that you have for counseling or HR or anything else that to help working parents.
And again, this isn't all about, you know, having a feel good. I mean, that's nice too, but it's also a cost effective. It's a bottom line thing. If you have people burning out, that costs you.
Yeah, absolutely. And you want happy workers, because happy workers are productive workers. And the reality is many of them are going to be parents. So you may not be able to afford all this lavish stuff, or maybe, you know, what some people would consider the minimum that other companies offer, but do everything you can.
Including if all you can do is put up a bulletin board where people can talk about, where do I get one of those fold-up cribs? Do you need yours anymore? Can I borrow it? Counts.
It's so easy, but if it's so easy, why aren't you doing it?
Yeah. Kurt Nickus, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Thanks as always.
You got it.
Super Bowl 51 is this Sunday, and millions of viewers will tune in to watch the New England Patriots play the Atlanta Falcons. And of course, they'll be watching the commercials as well. The next day, the nation's most watched cable channel, ESPN, will debut a new version of its flagship show, SportsCenter. The 6 p.m. edition will have two new hosts, Jemele Hill and Michael Smith, who have been hosting a podcast and ESPN2 show called His and Hers. They join us now for this week's View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders. Jemele and Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks a lot.
So what's going to be different about this than the SportsCenter that we've all seen for years?
You know, I guess I would say they're cutting out the middleman. When people think SportsCenter, they think highlights, news, and information. But the 6 p.m. SportsCenter has always been something of a hybrid, or at least in recent years, it certainly has been something of a hybrid. So whereas your former SportsCenter anchors, in order to carry on a conversation about the day's news, may enlist the help of other analysts or opinionists, as we like to call ourselves, such as Jemele or myself, well, now we're just hosting it.
But more talk, yeah. More conversation, but,
yeah,
less
more
highlights.
Talk, more conversation, more fun. Not that they weren't having fun before, but nobody has fun quite like us.
Yeah, it'll be, you know, SportsCenter has really evolved a lot. It didn't just start with putting us on the six. I mean, over the last couple of years, most of the SportsCenters have become centered around conversations and discussion. But we'll still figure out to stick to our unofficial mantra, which was doing one dumb thing a day.
Well, but, you know, the trend that we've heard about for years with ESPN is that it wanted to be known as the place where whenever you tuned in, you would hear about the top sports stories of the day. And in fact, the news business has kind of followed that lead. And CNN now, you know, they pick one story and they just are on it all day long. Are you saying by making this change that that model doesn't work anymore?
No, I think what we're both saying, and certainly is the philosophy, not just for SportsCenter, but really if you look at all the commentary-based shows, is that they're all still news of the day shows. And yes, there may be some topics that may resonate differently than others, say like Colin Kaepernick with the National Anthem protest. That was a story that had a lot of layers to it. So it was covered a little bit differently given the different perspectives and the different layers. But most of the shows on ESPN are still news of the day. I mean, Mike and I aren't going to be talking about things that aren't topical.
More and more, it seems like people are not watching television in general to be informed as much as to be entertained. And so, because they can get their information from a variety of different sources, they can read. They can read, obviously, the internet, be old-fashioned, if you will, and read newspapers, listen to radio. By the time you get to us at 6, we're not going to be telling you a whole lot that you aren't familiar with or that somebody else can't also tell you, given that ESPN is no longer this monopoly as it relates to sports television. You're going to watch us because you like us.
Well, Jemele, you mentioned Colin Kaepernick. I want to ask you about that because in addition to that, there was also the story of the St. Louis Rams players raising their hands as they walked onto the field following the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson. Has a lot of the news in sports in recent years become more political than it's ever been before, do you think?
Well, sports has always been political. And I think we've either fooled ourselves or conveniently forgotten how much politics have always interfered with sports. We spent, obviously, last year commemorating and acknowledging, celebrating Muhammad Ali. I mean, he's one of the most political figures to ever, you know, be in sports. And even just at every turn, it's always been there, especially the, you know, you look at it, worldwide events like the Olympics. But I think even more so now, sports is dragging us into this conversation, whether we want to be or not. So that stick to sports stuff just really isn't realistic or applicable, not only just with Colin Kaepernick. If you look at what's happening in the country right now, I mean, we have a very polarizing person in office, and a lot of athletes are reacting to that. You know, you saw that with this executive order with the, you know, ban on travel and the immigration ban, rather, and how that impacted Olympic athletes. And even the NBA, who reached out to the State Department to try to be reassured and to try to understand what this policy meant. So there are quite a lot of things happening in sports that don't allow us to have that distance as if this were, you know, not reality. Because we hear that from sports fans all the time about how sports is their escape. But that's just not realistic. And it never has been that way.
It's also a very privileged position to take. I watch sports to escape from reality. When that's probably not your reality, then you're probably watching sports to escape from the realities of the rest of the world. The bad news that the rest of the world is forced to deal with. Anybody, you know, that's a member of certain communities that have been prone to more injustice than others, realizes that whether you play sports or watch sports, when you turn it off or step off the field or the court, you still have to deal with the issues in this society. So the people who say, oh, you know, stick to sports, if I want politics, I'll go somewhere else, you're probably saying that because it's not your problem. Hmm. And that's a big issue across the board in our society, is that if it doesn't affect you, you know, it's hard to conjure up the appropriate level of outrage. And I think that's what a lot of people are missing, who are on the wrong side of history or the wrong side of certain issues. And it's not just about athletes speaking out about political issues. And as a brief aside, and Jamel and I talk about this all the time, we got to stop using politics as a catch-all, because there are certain social and moral issues that politics kind of trivializes them. You know, this isn't about policy. This is about right and wrong when it comes to matters such as, you know, racism, brutality, domestic abuse. And that's, and those issues that I just ran down, so a lot of those things end up coming out of the locker room. You think about the domestic violence issue, primarily in the National Football League, but across all sports. That's a societal problem, and sports was simply a reflection of that. So we'd be going out of our way to stick our head in the sand if we did not aggressively address a lot of these issues. And if people are uncomfortable, that's the point. It's time to make people more uncomfortable. We've been way too comfortable turning to sports and turning a blind eye to issues that face our citizens every day.
Would you be surprised if an athlete was the person to run against Donald Trump in 2020, if, you know, a LeBron James or somebody decided they wanted to run for president?
Now, that might be a little shocking, but I wouldn't be surprised if you saw more athletes in general cross over into politics because of how they feel that they can use their voices. You know, I don't know if one will be bold enough to run for president. And it's hard to address now, because that's something maybe 20 or 30 years from now we can say, oh, OK, that person has decided to run. Mm. But I do think the one thing that is very encouraging about this political cycle and just about this time that we are in right now is that you do have a lot of athletes who feel far more empowered to use their voice and to speak up on the issues that resonate with them. Because I think we went through a long period with them in particular where they didn't feel comfortable entering that space, or they felt like it was too big of a risk to ever speak up on something. And now I think they feel more of a sense of duty and obligation to do it.
One more question. We've got probably a number of listeners who are not people that pay attention to sports on a daily basis. What do you tell people that aren't interested in sports about why they should be?
Why they should be interested in sports in general?
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
I'm sure you've got friends who, you know, don't like to come over and watch the football game on the weekend or something like that, but you want to convince them to do it.
Well, I don't like watching football with people anyway, though. I watch sports by myself, maybe with my son. That's about it. Even with my wife, when I watch it with her, I'm like, stop asking me so many questions. That's a tough question, because sports is all, honestly, I have to stop and think about that. You know, didn't want to have a radio silence here going, because sports has always been such a big part of my life and everybody's life that I'm really close with. Every time I meet somebody and they don't know who I am, what I do, or anything about what I do, and they say, well, I'm not really into sports, I'm like, that's actually good. You know what I mean?
Like, okay.
You should. I'm glad you pay attention to the, you know, technology and the stock market. Maybe you could educate me on some of these things. Let's discuss politics anyway. But I just think there's just so many, you know, not to be cliche, but there are so many lessons, so many forms of inspiration that can be drawn from sports stories when it comes to people overcoming adversity and succeeding against all odds, or just coming together and working together. I mean, you know, if our country, our government, our leaders, if they want to find an example of people that can set aside differences for the common good, well, you know, you start with sports.
Michael Smith and Jemele Hill, they are taking over the 6 p.m. Sports Center slot on Monday on ESPN. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
The fighting continues in Syria. The government said today it's expanding its military offensive in the north after driving rebels out of the city of Aleppo. The Assad regime and forces fighting and are supposed to resume talks later this month, but so far negotiations haven't made any progress toward ending the nearly 6-year civil war. BBC Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen was in ravaged East Aleppo recently. And Jeremy, I'm looking at your pictures. Stunning. There's complete devastation, rubble. And then a pastry chef has set out cupcakes. How would you describe what's happening in East Aleppo, which was home to some of the opposition and suffered the most bombardment?
Well, I took quite a lot of still pictures when I was there because I just thought the images, potential images there were so striking. The sights were quite amazing. I've been covering wars and conflicts for a very long time, most of my career, and I've probably been to more than 20. And with the exception of Chechnya, Grozny, in the former Soviet Union, in the mid-90s, I've seen nothing really that equates to it.
Well, and it's a place that we've seen images before from it, the little boy sitting in the back of the ambulance. We saw there were attempts at ceasefire so that people could leave. But the Russians and the Assad regime they back were worried that some of the opposition fighters were in those crowds. Still, you can't believe anyone's still living here. It's such devastation. Who are these people?
Those devastated areas, there are actually some people who are coming back to them, mainly because they have nowhere really else to go. They may have been living as displaced people somewhere else in the city, somewhere else in the country. But they've gone back to what were their homes because they've got nowhere else to be. That's the main thing. I went into the apartment of one couple and they had a kid, but he was still with the grandparents because it was very dodgy around where they were. And most of the street was trashed. Their building was damaged, but not so severely damaged. So they thought that they would just come and live back in their apartment because they didn't have a choice, really, about where to go. The thing about the level of displacement that's happened in Syria since the war started, and more than half the population have lost their homes because of the war, and many have been displaced internally many, many times. Mm. The whole point about that is it's very impoverishing. People might have had a few savings to start with, but after they've been moved on a couple of times, really there's nothing left and they're near destitute. So if they have an address they can go to, they go to it.
Yeah, here's a picture. You've got two teenagers in sneakers and jeans, you know, running down a road. And the caption, teenage lords of the ruins. The war's taken their education, their childhoods, lives and limbs. Another picture of a terrible damage, but then a display of vegetables. So some food is getting in. But look, what is there any doubt that President Assad is going to stay in power no matter what happens at these talks?
I think the way things stand right now, Assad is looking more secure in power than he's been at any time since the war started, because he's had so much help from his big friends, the Russians and Iran, and also help from Hezbollah and other militia groups as well. Hezbollah, the Lebanese group, very closely allied with Iran. And so I think as a result of this, he's in no mood to try and make concessions. And I think Iran and the Russians have decided that he's their man. And I think that they have outmaneuvered the West, the Americans and their allies. And that side now is making the running. It has the initiative. Everybody else is trying to catch up.
Well, what about President Trump talking about setting up safe zones now in Syria for people fleeing the civil war? The debate had always been for, you know, these kinds of no-fly zones. How do you manage them? I mean, if a U.S. plane and a Russian plane are fighting over whether something should be a safe zone, that could end badly.
I think they could have a safe zone if the Russians agree to it. I don't know if President Trump likes to have the Russians to have a right of veto over what he does.
And why wouldn't the Russians agree to it? I mean, finish that thought.
I don't think the Russians particularly want the war to go on. And the Russian agenda is much wider than simply, let's see what we can do to help Assad and what the hell if we cause a few civilian casualties. What they're trying to do is establish themselves once again as a world power. And fighting here, showing what they can do, showing what their weapons can do, showing that they can keep their man in power, showing that they can act decisively when the West was basically dithering, is something which for them is desirable. And calming things down would also be a desirable thing to do.
Well, but as far as the safe zones, Russia has been using all this air power. A safe zone would mean that they couldn't decide that one of these safe zones was actually harboring people in the opposition and bomb it.
I just think the idea of safe zones may have flown a couple of years ago, but I don't think it's going to happen now. I think that if there's any agenda there from the Assad side, allied with Russia and Iran, it's to try to perhaps strengthen their position around the capital. There are still quite large amounts of territory that the various rebel groups control near Damascus. And I think if they have another target, it probably would be that.
Yeah. That's the BBC Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen talking about his recent trip to Aleppo in Syria. We'll have all those pictures at hereandnow.org. Jeremy, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.